Araminta slipped out of Danal's apartment and tiptoed across the vestibule to her own. Outside, a brash dawn light was lapping against the weather dome. The crowd was cheering ecstatically. That felt good.
Well, what do you know? I saved the universe.
Araminta grinned wildly at the ridiculous knowledge, then yawned. Being a hero was actually quite exhausting. She sank down into the big old armchair with its strangely lumpy cushions. Just 5 minutes' rest. Cheriton McConnor didn't like the in-character clothes Beckia had produced for him out of the replicator on board Elvin's Payback. Really didn't. Nothing wrong with the touch of them. A cotton shirt, wool-lined waistcoat with brass buttons, and trousers that were like suede but a great deal softer. No, it was the colours and style. The shirt's lace up front, its grey-green colour which was more like a stain than a dye, and the odd tight cut of the black trousers. He plain refused to wear the felt hat with its flamboyant green and blue feathers, although he reluctantly agreed to carry it after Beckia got all stroppy. It wasn't good to get Beckia stroppy. She'd been right, of course. As soon as he walked into the Confluence Nest building on Dariad Avenue in the center of town, he fitted in with the Elezalin workforce. Security was strong around the building, an old brick cube with dark arching windows. Colwyn's 3 Confluence Nests were the first priority for the occupying forces. But Leatris McPeel had done his job well, infiltrating a complete legend for Cheriton, including DNA. When he walked into the airy marble-floored lobby, he was told to put his hand on a sensor pedestal, while 3 armed and armored guards watched him cautiously. The building's new net cleared him, and they waved him on. He gave them a cheery smile, backed up with a contented emanation into the Gaia field. The nest itself was housed on the 4th floor in a sterile chamber which took up half of the available floor space. He reported for duty to Dream Master Yenrol in the Overseer's office, which looked out into the nest chamber through a glass partition. Normally, the office was only occupied a few hours each day, when the Overseer or their assistant ran a 6-hourly assessment to ensure the nest was operating smoothly. Now there were 7 technicians, all struggling for elbow space, as they installed banks of new hardware, while on the other side of the glass, more technicians were blending fresh bioneural clusters with the original nest.
"What's your field?" Yenrol asked. He was both agitated and puzzled.
Cheriton's late assignment, coupled with the pressure to get the job done, was making him very twitchy.
"Pattern definition," Cheriton replied equitably. "The routines I've developed will help isolate the second dreamer's thoughts within the Gaia field. It should give us a stronger source to trace."
"Good," Yenrol said.
"Okay, great. Start installing the routines."
He turned back to a half-completed hardware unit before Cheriton got a chance to reply.
"Okay, then," Cheriton mumbled, keeping his Gaia field emission a level flow of eagerness and enthusiasm. He found a free console seat and nodded to the man in the next seat.
"Welcome to the Eye," his new colleague said. "I'm Danal."
"Glad to be here," Cheriton said.
"What do you mean, Eye?"
"Of the storm."
Cheriton grinned.
"This is the quiet part."
"Exactly."
Danal, it turned out, had been on Vyosha for some time now. He and Mereble had come in anticipation of being close to the second dreamer.
"We wanted to be here when he revealed himself," Danal admitted. "I've been upgrading nest sensitivity since we arrived in the hope our dream masters can locate him."
He gave Yenrol a guilty glance, stifling his Gaia field emissions for a moment.
"I wasn't expecting this," he confided.
"I know what you mean," Cheriton said, all sympathy. "I was praying to the lady that Ethan would be elected cleric conservator, but I didn't think anything like our presence here would be necessary."
Danal gave an awkward shrug and got back to work. Cheriton continued loading in the routines he'd concocted. They did perform the recognition function, but in reverse, so that the nest would develop a mild blind spot should it receive any thoughts originating from the second dreamer. It would inform Cheriton first before reverting to the advertised function. The modification team's frantic work stalled as Justine's madcap flight swamped the Unisphere.
"She's so close," Danal said in awe,
as the Silverbird sensors revealed the undulating surface of the void. Then everyone winced as the Rael transformed the second moon into a hyperluminal quake.
"How are they doing that?" Cheriton murmured, fascinated by the level of extraordinary, sophisticated violence involved.
"Who cares?" Denal said. "The void can resist their devilry. It has for a million years. That's all that matters."
Cheriton raised an eyebrow. It took a lot of self-control not to leak his dismay at the man's bigotry into the Gaia field.
"Let's hope Justine's ship can withstand it too."
"She's not a believer. She's an ANA creature."
"She's human," Cheriton said. "That means she should be able to get inside. Somehow."
"Ah, I hadn't thought of that."
"Please," Yenrol entreated the modification team. "Keep working. If the second Dreamer is going to show himself, it will be tonight."
Denal flashed Cheriton a shamefaced smile.
Oscar hadn't expected things to happen quite this fast. He should have known better. If the Starflyer War had taught him nothing else, it was that events ruled people, not the other way round. So here he was, encased in a stiff paramilitary armor suit, sitting halfway down the passenger section of an Alezalin police capsule, floating over the cairns. Becchio was sitting on the bench next to him, while Tamancio was forward in the command seat. The capsules were designed to hold 15 paramilitaries. However, its original occupants were now resting in a drug-induced coma back in the Bootle and Lester warehouse, so at least he had plenty of room to stretch out. Like the rest of the Commonwealth, they were accessing Justine's mad dash through the Gulf.
"The welcome team has just stepped up to active status," Leatris reported.
He had stayed behind in the Elvin's payback to monitor the occupying forces and provide Unisphere support. "Everyone thinks that the second Dreamer will intervene for Justine."
"He didn't after Gore's appeal," Oscar said.
"The Rael should give things a degree of urgency," Becchio said. "I agree with Living Dream. If it's going to happen, it'll happen tonight."
Oscar shrugged, which didn't come off well in his armor.
"Did you know Gore and Justine?" Tamancio asked.
"I think I met her once. Some senior officer function on High Angel. Everyone was trying to chat her up."
"Including you?" Becchio teased.
"No. I was aiming for the ones she turned down. Rejection always leaves you vulnerable to a quick bout of cheap, meaningless sex."
"Ozzy, but you're dreadful."
"Anything from Cheriton?" Tamancio asked.
"Nothing since his last check-in," Leatris reported. "Nobody questioned his appointment to General's staff. He's installed his routines in the nest."
"Is he wearing his hat?" Becchio asked innocently.
Oscar couldn't help the smile creeping onto his mouth. That had been quite an argument.
"I'll find out next time," Leatris promised.
"What have you got for us on the welcome team?" Tamancio asked.
"All deeply loyal Living Dream followers. It doesn't look like Phelim fancied contracting out for this job. They're on secondment from the Macathran II Cabinet Security Office."
"Ethan's private bodyguards," Tamancio declared. "What are their enrichments?"
"Very heavy-duty weapons, and they're accelerated up to at least our standard. But I don't think they have bionics. There's no record in any file I can find."
"Okay, thank you. Keep deep mining. I want everything you've got on them."
"Will do. File's coming over."
Oscar's U-Shadow told him it had received the heavily encrypted files. When he scrutinized them, he couldn't help a sharp intake of breath. The welcome team that Councillor Phelim had put together to interdict the second Dreamer were carrying the kind of firepower he'd thought exclusive to members of the Knight's Guardian. They were also extremely devout. Phelim had given them complete authority over all the invading forces to accomplish their goal.
"We need to be quick," he murmured.
"That we do," Tamancio agreed. "I wouldn't want to be caught in the act by this lot."
"I bet they have got bionics," Becchio said. "They'll justify it by saying it will help bring about the dream. Their kind always does."
"I didn't know Living Dream disapproved of bionics," Oscar said.
"Oh yes, nothing like the Protectorate, though. Bionics aren't quite a sacrilege. They simply don't have any place in the void. Most people believe they won't work in there anyway."
"Why?"
because there was never any functioning technology on Quarentia. The most sophisticated thing the Water Walker ever encountered was the machine gun, and that's purely mechanical. There was no electricity, no genetics, no bionics. Given the humans who landed, their ship would have had access to the most advanced technology and information base the Commonwealth could provide. It is inconceivable that their new society couldn't even make a battery. They certainly know their chemistry and medicine, even astronomy. Something stopped them from following the electromechanical route.
The internal structure of the void, Oscar mused.
Quite. Whatever the quantum structure is that permits true mental powers, it must also block electricity.
That's ridiculous. You can't stop current flowing.
That implies a whole level of atomic reactions would cease to exist. There wouldn't be any stars.
The Sylphan paths mess with human hardware-based technology, Timancio said.
That's direct interference generated by their paths.
All I'm saying is that it appears there's something inimical to electronics in the void.
The original colony ship survived to land on Quarentia.
And the Living Dream is still arguing if it landed or crashed, Beccia said. The interference with electronics could come directly from the heart itself, like some kind of overlord making sure civilization doesn't rise above a certain level.
What the hell would anyone go to so much trouble making the void in the first place, just so they can use it to keep sentient species as pets?
No idea, she said merrily. The first life are alien, remember? They think differently.
Oscar gave up with an irritable wave of his hand.
All right. So thanks to the whole first life zookeeper theory, the Welcome Team are unlikely to have bionics.
That's about it, yeah, Timancio said. Either way, Beccia said, we don't want to go head to head if we can help it.
Right.
Leatris, can you get us assigned to the Welcome Team backup, please? Timancio asked.
Way ahead of you. Your assignment should be coming through in a couple of minutes.
Thank you. Oscar drew a sharp breath as the Rael warships obliterated a gas giant.
Jesus H. Christ, give the poor girl a break.
The Silverbird dropped back into real space.
Oscar grimaced at the radiation battering its force fields, his memory flipping back to the fight for Hanko when he'd captained the Dublin. There were a lot of parallels.
Warning Light Mountain's ships had used exotic energy blasts to smack the Dublin about. And at 500,000 kilometers above the surface, their force field had only just withstood the star's radiation. All that was nothing compared to the hell Silverbird was now enduring.
Oscar couldn't help the burst of encouragement pouring out of his mind and into the Gaia field, as if prayer alone could make a difference.
Justine powered back into hyperspace.
Good tactic, Oscar said approvingly.
Another part of his mind was dwelling on the fact that the Elvin's Payback was the same type of ship as Silverbird.
We could be out there doing that.
Stand by, Cheriton said on the ultra-secure link. The second Dreamer is making contact with the Skylord.
Where is he?
Timancio growled out. Armor active, please. Oscar, do exactly as we tell you, clear?
Yes.
He just managed not to add, sir.
Haven't got his position yet, Cheriton said. My routines are still fudging the nest for us.
Oscar opened his mind wide to the Gaia field.
Close to you now. Feel for her,
the second Dreamer was imploring.
Here we go,
Cheriton said. First fix is the Bodant district.
En route, Timancio said, and pushed the capsule round in a 180-degree curve above the Dark River.
Vyosha's dawn sun shone into the capsule through the forward section of the transparent fuselage.
Ah, crap! The rest of the nests are focusing on the origin, Cheriton said. I thought they'd take longer.
Timancio pushed their speed up.
Ozzy, how long have we got?
30,000 light-years away, the void began to extend out towards the Silverbird.
If it screws with technology, is she going to be all right when she's inside?
Oscar asked.
Let's just concentrate on the job you've given us, shall we?
Beccia chided. She was activating her armor. The helm advisor rippled shut.
He's near the edge of the park, Cheriton told them. The Dream Masters are pulling out some very precise coordinates. Damn, they're good. Sorry, guys, you're not going to make it.
The welcome team is being given his location. Shit! Timancio reducing their speed. I'll look suspicious if we arrive a couple of seconds before them, and that's all the time we've got.
What's plan B? Oscar asked.
Snatch him away from the welcome team, but that's going to be difficult. This is all happening too fast. I wanted to be properly embedded in the occupation forces here before we move to this phase. Kill the wormhole, Beckia said. We can use Elvin's payback to intercept the welcome team in interstellar space when they ship the second dreamer back to Alezalin.
That would give us a better chance, Oscar said. That ship's a damn sight better than anything living dream will have.
We don't know that, Timancio said, and it would take a lot of aggression to take out the wormhole.
I could go through and do it, Leatris insisted.
They'd know exactly what happened and why, Timancio said. This is looking like we'll have to switch operations to Alezalin itself. Oh, here we go. Deployment orders from the welcome team. It's an apartment building.
Something's wrong here, Cheriton said. One of my new colleagues, Danal, is having a fit. That apartment block is where he lives. As best we can determine, the second dreamer is actually in his own apartment.
Aha! Everybody might just be underestimating the second dreamer after all, Timancio said. Good for him.
And for us, Beckia agreed.
He's going to have to get out of there quick, Oscar said. He was viewing an exo-image map of Colwyn. 9 cruisers were converging on Bodunt Park. 5 had orders to establish a secure ground perimeter. 2 were assigned to provide air cover. The rest, including theirs, were to back up the welcome team inside. He glanced down as they passed over the bright aluminum buildings of a marina, then on across the park. There were thousands of people spread across the grass, still cheering and jumping up and down with glee as their all-night vigil was rewarded. A real party atmosphere had developed, and the pull it exerted through the Gaia field was intoxicating. The capsule carrying the welcome team roared overhead, barely subsonic and decelerating hard. Up ahead, the glass pillar corners of the target apartment block gleamed with a purple and blue iridescence, naively signaling its position. The welcome team capsule circled it possessively, trailing a thin vapor trail. Happy people down in the park frowned upwards at the boorish intrusion. Dismay and resentment appeared in the Gaia field like necrotic sunspots in an otherwise healthy corona.
Oh, great,
Oscar grunted, as more and more celebrating citizens became indignant and aggrieved.
That'll help.
They don't care, Timancio said. This whole planet doesn't matter to them. All they're interested in is finding the second dreamer.
I wonder what he's like, Oscar said, as they slowed to hover above the strip of well-maintained gardens in front of the block.
Neurotic, Beckia said. Got to be.
Smart and scared, Timancio said, which makes him dangerous to living dream. The rest of the capsules assigned to support the welcome team arrived.
This is Major Honola, the welcome team commander announced. Perimeter squad, establish yourselves immediately. No one in or out. Jangle pulse, anyone who attempts to cross your line. Custody support squad, seal off the ground floor and shut down the lifts. Use the stairwell to isolate each floor. Now listen up. I want to make very sure you all understand this. There is to be no lethal weapons usage at all. The second dreamer is in there, and he must not be harmed. If you encounter any problem, for example, if he is using a force field and tries to break through, call us. We will deal with him. I don't want your dirty hands on him.
Yes, sir, Timancio replied, as he directed their capsule down onto the garden. The welcome team's capsule was planting itself on the roof next to the golden crystal dome containing the spa.
What do we do?
Oscar asked, as the door expanded and he stepped out onto a border of fuchsia bushes, his boots crushing the white and scarlet flowers into the loam.
Exactly as we were told, Timancio said. And remember, don't use your bionic field function. I know it's superior to anything in these armor suits, but the welcome team will detect it.
Okay.
They joined the rest of the custody support troops as they marched into the ground floor lobby. Behind them, the perimeter squad started to push back the first batch of angry citizens who'd arrived from the park.
Danal has just been arrested, Cheriton told them.
Two officers from Cabinet Security are hauling him off right now. He's not a happy man.
That must be a deliberate distraction, Timancio said.
Yeah, but by who? Beccia said. The second dreamer or another bunch like us?
The lobby was filled with contractors' equipment and caskets piled high with rubbish. Bright temporary lighting on a metal frame cast strong shadows.
The welcome team have taken command of the apartment block's net, Cheriton said. Hang on, I'm assessing the results from their scrutineers.
Timancio led Beccia and Oscar into the concrete stairwell. More rubbish had been casually tipped off the floors above, forming a heap of dusty debris at the bottom of the stairs in the basement. A couple of paramilitaries went down to investigate the garage.
According to the net, there are about 30 people currently in residence, Cheriton said. The whole damn place is being redeveloped. The fourth floor only has 4 people registered for 2 apartments, Denal and Mareble, and a married couple. Someone called Araminta is refurbishing the remaining 3 on that level. Mining her now.
Oscar hurried up the concrete stairs. The long line of suited paramilitaries were making a lot of noise as they trooped up with him. Instructions relayed from Honolar assigned 6 of them to each floor. Oscar was seriously impressed with Leatris when he, Timancio, and Beccia were given the 4th floor. They emerged into the vestibule to find all the apartment doors broken open, and 2 of the welcome team standing guard in full military armor suits. Oscar could just see through the doorway into apartment 3, where the terrified occupants were in the middle of the big living room. A man and woman, him in a pair of shorts, her in a long nightshirt. Standing side by side, their arms raised as another of the welcome team covered them with a large gun. She was shaking and crying while her partner was trying to be resolute. The way his leg muscles were trembling betrayed him more than any Gaiafield emission. Major Honolar came out of Denal's apartment.
No sign of him. He couldn't have got out of the building. He didn't have time. I want every resident on every floor in custody and taken to our headquarters. Search and scan each apartment. Make sure you have everyone.
He turned and went back in to Denal's apartment.
Pair up, Timancio said. Take an apartment each.
Oscar accompanied Timancio as they went into apartment number 4. He scanned round with his suit sensors, resenting how slow and restricted they were compared to a bionic field scan.
You're spoilt, he told himself.
The suit didn't detect any body size thermal signatures. The apartment was halfway through refurbishment. Several inactive bots were lined up in the living room. New cables and pipes were laid out along one wall. Junked utility fittings were stacked up by the door. Crates and boxes with Bovey's Building Supply Macro Store printed around them were waiting to be unpacked. Some furniture had been left. A coffee table that was now badly scuffed, with several mugs on top, waiting to be washed. An ancient couch with a matching armchair that had odd lumps in its cushioning. His U-Shadow was displaying the reports from the other squads who were busy rounding up the residents on other floors. So far, their identities matched their files.
In here, Timancio said, using their secure link. He was standing in the doorway to a bedroom. The bed itself was a bare mattress with a big sleeping bag crumpled on top. 4 suitcases were lined up along a wall. One was open, revealing a collection of woman's clothes. The small dresser was swamped by hairstyling tools and membrane scale cases.
Not listed as lived in, Oscar said.
Depends what lists you check. Leatris, run another search on Araminta. Has she sold this apartment?
I'm on it.
While Timancio checked the other 2 bedrooms, Oscar went into the main bathroom. The floor had been stripped back to the bare concrete, as had the walls. A brand new carved stone bath cuboid was sitting in the middle. Halfway up the wall behind it, the stub of the original cold water feed pipe jutted out of the concrete, its valve dripping into a plastic bucket beneath. The old toilet bowl was still plumbed in. A big hot water tank stood in one corner, already boxed in by the struts of a false wall, just awaiting the cover boards which were stacked in front of it. A maze of pipework was strewn round its base. Components for a spore shower were lying ready for assembly.
Nothing, he told Timancio.
The other bedrooms are empty.
Oscar found him behind the living room's kitchen bar. The old culinary unit had been removed to stand on the ground, though the nutrient feed pipes were still plumbed in.
A kettle and a microwave were sitting on the scratched marble work surface. His thermal scan showed him the kettle's temperature was above ambient.
"This place has been used recently," he muttered.
"We need to talk to her," Timancio said. "If anyone can tell us who's been in and out of these apartments, it's her."
"That shouldn't be too difficult," Oscar said. "We know who she is. Finding her will be easy for Leatris."
"Yeah." Timancio's senses swept round one last time. "Grab something from her bedroom, just so's we can run a DNA verification that she's the one living here. Then we'd better get back and help with rounding up the rest of the suspects."
"Poor bastards,"
Oscar said as he picked up a small scale applicator brush.
"What do you think Honala will do with them?"
"Good question.
How do you prove you're not the second dreamer? It's not as if there's physical evidence. I guess if he doesn't get a confession, they'll use a memory read."
Oscar shuddered.
"That isn't exactly going to endear them to the second dreamer. They need him to help them get into the void."
"Oscar, face it. With today's medical techniques, you can make someone do just about anything you want."
"Medical techniques?"
"That's what they started out as."
"I suppose you know how to do that."
"We all had training in that area, yes." Despite the heavy armor suit with its perfect insulation, Oscar suddenly felt cold. Paula had rarely experienced a pang of déjà vu as strong as the one that hit her when the stained glass door opened and she walked into the entrance hall. And she hadn't even been to the old building before. She walked past the empty concierge desk and stared at the glass cage lift. It was the age of everything around her that was generating that weird sensation tickling the back of her mind. According to the Daroka City Council files, the interior was perfectly authentic, exactly as it had been during the Starflyer War. She wasn't going to disagree. As someone who had lived through those times, she could feel the decor was right. The lift took her up to the fifth floor, and she walked into Troblum's penthouse apartment. On the trip over from the spaceport, she'd accessed Lieutenant Rennie Campus's ancient directorate files on the one time she'd visited. ANA had to deep access the memory. With the file came a note that Troblum had requested access to that same file 100 years ago, along with associated forensic reports. His restoration work was excellent, Paula acknowledged as she walked into the huge open-plan lounge. The balcony had a magnificent view out over the Casper River, with the rest of Daroka filling in the background. It didn't take her long to establish there wasn't anything useful in the apartment, and all Troblum's personal files had been wiped from the building net. The only mild exception was in the bedrooms, each of which inexplicably had their closets full of girls' clothes. Troblum's own clothes, comprising 3 aging toga suits and his unpleasant underwear, were stuffed into a chest of drawers in the master bedroom. For a moment, Paula wondered if the dresses belonged to Troblum's girlfriend. She raised an eyebrow when she took out a leather designer miniskirt. It might be slightly prejudiced of her to think it, but what would a girl with a figure to wear such an item see in Troblum? Then she recognized the label, one she hadn't seen for over 700 years, and realized that the skirt was also Starflyer War vintage style. She let out a whistle of admiration. He'd even reproduced the girl's wardrobe as best he could. Now that is true obsession. Paula started going through the other apartments in the ancient converted factory, while her U-Shadow accessed the building's net to analyze the remaining files. It was the largest apartment on the third floor which drew her attention. The others were all relatively authentic reproductions, but this one had been modified again. All the internal walls had been removed, and the resulting chamber sealed against the outside atmosphere with a sustainer membrane and clinical-grade air filters. Rows of heavy benches ran the entire length, each one equipped with a series of data nodes and high-voltage power sockets. She could see the outlines where objects had once rested. They must have been there for decades to make any kind of impression on the stainless steel surface. The net subsection for the apartment had also been thoroughly wiped. 3 courier capsules were requisitioned to collect items from the building around the time Troblum disappeared, her U-Shadow reported.
What items?
Unknown. They were stored in stabilized cases.
Ah,
Paula said. I bet it was a collection. Most likely Starflyer War memorabilia. Stubbsy Florak often procured historic relics for clients. Where were the cases taken?
The capsules made 3 separate trips, made to the city spaceport. They were collected by different commercial ships registered in the external worlds. No record of their ultimate destination.
It was to Florak.
She knew it. That's why Troblum was there, to pick it up. And it would have meant a great deal to him. That can only mean he was planning to leave the Commonwealth entirely. She opened a link to ANA.
Troblum was more scared than I realized.
Marius does that to people.
Yes, but there was something else.
Remember what he told us when he first made contact. He had something that I would understand, and his mania is the Starflyer War, a time I am familiar with.
That hardly narrows it down.
Something else does, Paula said. All she could see was that figure ascending into its ship amid the ruins of Florak's villa. A slight person, that wiggle of the hips, a taunt, a couldn't-care-less contempt. None of today's agents and representatives had that kind of attitude, not even the Knight's Guardian. They all prided themselves on their steely professionalism.
I have a bad feeling about this.
What feeling?
I have one last trip to make. I'll tell you after that.
Can't you tell me now?
No.
Believe it or not, I'd be embarrassed if I'm wrong. You'll think I'm obsessive.
I have to know for myself.
How intriguing.
As you wish.
Are you making any progress on mining Troblum's life for me?
Yes. In many ways he is an odd person, especially for a hire. I have a reasonably complete timeline for you. It has some suspicious gaps, and he even served on a scientific mission for the Navy.
Really? Paula's U-Shadow received the file. She scanned the contents list in her exovision. One of the more recent items attracted her.
A presentation to the Navy about the Anomine and the Dyson Pear Barrier generators. And Casimir himself was there. I'd like a summary of that, please.
Of course.
Thanks.
I'll review it on my way back to Earth.
You're coming here?
Yes.
This little problem of mine will only take a moment to confirm. I'll be there in an hour.
Major Hanalar rounded up 33 people from the apartment block and shipped them back to the security headquarters that were set up in Colwyn's docks. The cordon around the building was maintained, even in the face of growing hostility from the crowd in the park. 5 paramilitaries from the support squad made one final sensor sweep after the transport capsules carted off the unfortunate residents. But they found nothing. Once they'd finished, they left, reassigned to other more urgent duties. The occupying forces were having a hard time of it as more and more of Iosha's inhabitants joined the physical protests against their presence. An hour and a half after the last of the suited figures clumped out of apartment 4 on the 4th floor, the muffled sound of a power tool resonated round the bathroom. One after the other, 3 fixing bolts around the top of the hot water tank spun round, then dropped onto the floor. The hemispherical top of the tank tipped up a fraction. Fingers appeared in the gap and pushed against the thick thermal insulation foam, shoving the top aside. It too fell onto the floor with a loud clang.
Sweet Ozzy,
Araminta groaned. She took a long time just to lever herself up to a standing position. The cylinder was only just big enough to hold her in a terrible crouch position. Every limb throbbed as she finally stretched them free. Cramp attacked her joint muscles, bringing tears to her eyes. She was close to sobbing when she eventually straightened her spine. It was another 5 minutes of simply standing and letting the pain subside before she attempted to climb out, using the false wall boxing as a ladder. The only noise was the crowd outside jeering and taunting the paramilitaries on the cordon. Araminta peered cautiously into the living room. Nobody about. Her macrocellular clusters couldn't detect any individual data signals. She'd isolated herself from the Unisphere, and knew she couldn't reconnect without being detected. She crossed the living room, feeling unnervingly exposed. The main door was ajar, its expensive brass lock broken, which drew a scowl.
As far as she could determine, the whole fourth floor was deserted. She shut the door and jammed a crate of kitchen fittings behind it.
"Okay, then," she said,
and sat down in the ancient armchair. Got up again, went over to the kettle. She was just about to switch it on when she wondered if some tricky little monitor program would notice the power usage. 5 minutes later, she'd extracted the power cell from a bot and wired it up to the kettle. She sat back down in the armchair with a cup of wonderfully hot tea and some of the classy chocolate biscuits she always kept around. So now what?